The actor George Takei was imprisoned with his family during World War II by his own government. They were part of the 120,000 Japanese Americans forced into 10 internment camps beginning in 1942. Takei talks a lot about the experience. He's written about it. He's given speeches and TED Talks, acted in plays about it. And he always says the worst day of the experience was the first one.
Of course, we know what led up to it. The bombing of Pearl Harbor.
On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards.
And the war hysteria in the country.
Costly to our Navy was the loss of war vessels.
And how that hysteria affected the leadership of this country.
The unifying America in its determination to fight and win the war thrust upon it.
Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. Most were loyal, but no one knew.
They acted without rational thought and without evidence. And an executive order was signed by the President of the United States, which ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast, 120,000 of us, to be summarily rounded up and imprisoned in barbed wire confinement. Barbed wire fences, sentry towers, machine guns pointed at us from it. The executive order was signed on February 19th, 1942, and on April 20th, I turned 5 years old, and a few weeks after that, my father got me up. My brother, a year younger, was in the same bedroom with me, and he got us up, dressed us hurriedly, and told us to wait in the living room while our parents did some last-minute packing. In the bedroom, we had a sister, an infant, who was back in the bedroom with our parents. And so my brother and I were just gazing out the front window, just checking out the neighborhood. And suddenly we saw two soldiers carrying rifles with shiny bayonets on them. I remember the shine on the bayonets because it was a nice sunny morning. That sound seemed to make the whole house tremble. We were terrified. My father came out of the bedroom and answered the door, and at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home. My father came back out with the luggage, and we followed him out onto the driveway, and we waited for our mother to come out. And when she came out, there was a soldier escorting her. She had our baby sister in one arm, a huge, heavy-looking duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. There we were in our two-bedroom home on Garnet Street, being ordered out by American soldiers. This in America. Due process simply disappeared. No charges, no trial, no evidence of any kind of unpatriotic subterfuge happening. And yet, we were categorized as enemy aliens. That's the scene that's burned into my memory.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. George Takei is with us through the hour. His story seemed particularly relevant this week in the aftermath of a mass shooting in Atlanta where a white gunman killed 8 people. 6 were of Asian descent. The motive of those shootings is still unclear, but all of this comes at a time when there's been a sharp rise in anti-Asian racism and multiple hate crimes have been reported over the last year. Takei joined us early this week, before the shootings, actually. We wanted to talk about his book that he's written for young adults. It's a graphic memoir. They Called Us Enemy. One of the things George explores in the book is this idea of memory. It's not always dependable, but he talks about how his memories of the camp are rich with these sensations, smells, this feeling of heat and cold. Sometimes they're vague. Sometimes, like the day the soldiers came, they're more vivid.
That was so intense, first of all, to see soldiers marching up our driveway in full uniform, carrying those 2 rifles and seeing this sharp, pointy thing and the sun, California sun, glinting on it. It's the intensity of events, I think, that burn itself into people's memories. And so that's the memory I have of the beginning of our imprisonment. But in actual fact, after that, you know, for a child, a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old, it became something of an adventure. I remember the anxiety and the older people, particularly women, well, my mother and other women crying. But we're children. We chased each other and play hide and go seek. So, you know, it's a slippery thing called a child's memory. You remember the intensity of certain experiences, but the intensity is also the child's fun. You're learning things. You're experiencing new things, adventure, amazement. And then when we arrived in Arkansas, it was a whole alien world to us. The intense feeling is the amazement of a strange new world, not the anguish that my parents were going through. And I in the book, I talk about the parallel experiences, the same experience, but seen from a different vantage point. To me, as a child, it was discovery, adventure, learning new things. For my parents, it was outrage, contained anguish, the anxiety of not knowing what's going to happen to us. My father was one of those unusual people of his generation. When I asked questions, he talked to me about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to come back to that, actually, because it gets us to the unique nature of the conversations you had with your father. You write that from the moment the war began, that your loyalty as Americans was constantly under suspicion. And I wanted to ask you more about that, because this is another thing you explore in the book, this idea that it doesn't make a difference whether a person whether a Japanese American was an American citizen or not. This was one of the ideas that they had. Japanese Americans had a larger cultural loyalty to the emperor, this racial allegiance to the emperor of Japan. And this was something that comes up a lot in this story. Earl Warren, you mentioned, former Supreme Court Chief Justice, the mayor of Los Angeles, pushes this idea too, the idea that the blood will tell. Talk about this idea, because it really seemed to drive what was going on at the time.
And these people had no evidence of what they were talking about. Yeah. Attorney General Earl Warren, who, of course, we know went on to become the great liberal Supreme Court Chief Justice. He was the Attorney General, and he had a nefarious motivation, self-serving motivation. He wanted to run for governor. He had his eyes on the governor's seat, and he needed an issue that he could run on that would get him the kind of vote that he needed. And he saw that the people were all agitated. They were terrorized by the military of Japan. I find the idea of leadership interesting. Earl Warren was a great leader, as it turned out, and President Roosevelt was a great leader when during the Depression and during the war. But sometimes leaders get led by the people who are intensely terrorized, and they become the leaders. Earl Warren saw that he needed an issue, and he said, he made an amazing statement for the top attorney of the state. He said, "We have no reports of spying or sabotage or fifth column activities by the Japanese." We weren't Japanese Americans. He said, "by the Japanese." And that is ominous, ominous, because the Japanese are inscrutable. You can't tell what they're thinking. They have this placid expression on their face. And so it would be prudent as a preventative measure to lock them up before they do anything.
Wow. So the lack of evidence was the evidence.
Absence of evidence was, for him, the evidence. And he just made that up. I mean, it was a fact that they had no reports because there were no spies or saboteurs from the Japanese-American community. There was no evidence, and that became the evidence to incarcerate us.
It's interesting. I wanted to talk about one of the things that you've mentioned is that the experience in the camps gave you your identity. And one of the elements of your identity, Mr. Takei, is your sense of activism. And I wanted to talk about the influence of your parents on all of that, in particular your mother's story, which is really interesting. You talk about how she had this duffel bag, this rather heavy duffel bag that she carried, right? And no one knew what was in it, I guess, and she wouldn't let anyone carry the bag for her. And she finally reveals, once you get into the camp, she finally reveals that she has, against orders, brought her own sewing machine. Now, this was the thing I wanted to ask you about this story. You mentioned that on some level you were wondering, and this is how you put it in the book, if everything she did was her own statement of defiance. Would you just talk about that? And I wonder if you feel or felt influenced by the defiance you saw by your parents.
My mother was a tough lady. My father was, I think, an extraordinary man. At that, you know, at growing up, you never think your father's extraordinary, but thinking of all my friends of my generation's parents, I said that, you know, they didn't talk about it. My father talked about it to me as I was growing up. And what my father emphasized was that our democracy is a people's democracy. It's based on the people. It's dependent on the people. And it functions with the people's participation. It's a participatory democracy. But people are fallible human beings. He said the ideals of democracy are noble ideals. Rule of law, equal justice, due process. They're noble ideas. But it's in a democracy, it's dependent on the people to make it so, to make it what it says it is. And so, in part, the people of America was made hysterical. It was war hysteria and mixed with the toxic element of racism. And the president or the other leaders also were swept up by that, and they were led by that hysteria. And so they acted without evidence and driven by the hysteria of the times. And so we're in a democracy, he said. It's very important that citizens take on the responsibility of a democracy. And that requires, on the most basic level, to cast an informed vote. And he emphasized, and this is when I'm, you know, in my late teens, an informed vote. Just casting the vote is not the point. You have to know what you're voting about and voting for. And then to be actively, this is a participatory democracy, and we have to participate in that democracy, in that process, to make those ideals true, the ideal of equal justice under the law.
It's interesting, this deeper nuanced understanding of democracy that he has.
And he was born in Japan.
This is what I'm saying. I'm wondering, is it because, do you think that maybe immigrants or people who are discriminated against have come to this deeper understanding of democracy that Americans, a lot of Americans, frankly, just take for granted?
I agree with that. Because there's another, Asian immigrants face discrimination from the outset. Just by the fact that they are coming from Asia, immigrants coming from all over the world could someday hope to be naturalized American citizens, except immigrants coming from Asia. So from the moment that they stepped onto U.S. land, they were discriminated against. And so my father, even if he wanted to become a citizen, could not because of that policy. But after the war, and particularly because of the heroism of the segregated all-Japanese-American unit that came from behind American barbed wire fences and fought in Europe so heroically, that Congress passed the Walter McCarran Act, which granted naturalization to Asian immigrants. And that my father, for the first time, had the opportunity to become naturalized. At that time, my father had a grocery store in Watts, the African American community in South Los Angeles. And it was a long, hard day that he put in into the night hours, and he was dead tired when he came home. But there he was at the dining room table with those books, and he was studying to become a citizen of the United States. And I said, "Daddy, why are you working so hard to become the citizen of a country that treated you so terribly?" I just couldn't understand. He was dead tired from long hours at the store, and yet he was putting in further hours with the light going to become a citizen. And he said, "So many young Japanese Americans died so that I would have this opportunity. I have a responsibility to those young Japanese Americans who fought on the battlefields of Europe."
So after, of course, Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were not allowed at first to serve in the military. And then you mentioned later troops were needed and the policy changes a bit. And Japanese Americans would be allowed, but, and here's the crucial point, they had to prove they were loyal citizens. So I wanted to talk about this because you mentioned how the Army and the War Relocation Authority, they distributed these questionnaires to the people in the camps. And I want to have you talk to me about what these questionnaires said and the decision your parents had to make, because this is really remarkable.
Can you imagine after they've stripped you of everything, bank account, a property, everything, and imprison you for a year, and they realized that, you know, they could use you. And So how to establish a justification for drafting young men and women out of essentially an American concentration camp? Their solution was as crazy, as irrational, and as un-American as the incarceration itself. It was a questionnaire of about 30 questions, most of them innocuous. Everybody in all 10 camps over the age of 17 had to respond to this questionnaire. There were two questions that were so outrageous and so without any kind of thought behind it, or just ignorance, that that turned all 10 camps into turmoil. Question:
should we read them?
Well, I could paraphrase it. It makes it simpler.
Yeah, I mean, I've got them here in the from the book. Let me read them.
All right.
They're right here in the book, and they're just extraordinary. So, question number 27: are you willing to serve in the armed forces of the United States on combat duty wherever ordered? And then number 28 in the questionnaire: will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States of America and faithfully defend the United States from any or all attack by foreign or domestic forces, and forswear any form of allegiance or obedience to the Japanese emperor, to any foreign government power or organization? So these were the two questions, as you say,
right,
that created the turmoil. Talk about how your parents were thinking about those.
Well, let me take the first question 27. That being asked of my parents, will they bear arms to defend the United States of America? They had the three of us. We were children. By that time, I was 6 years old. My brother was five. My sister was a toddler. They were being asked to abandon their children in a prison camp and bear arms to defend the nation that's imprisoning their children. It was preposterous. There was no thought behind a question like that being addressed to couples who had young children. Question 28 was even more insidious. Essentially, I'm going to simplify it.
Yeah.
Will you swear your loyalty to the United States and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? Which means that they presumed that we had a pre-existing, inborn racial loyalty to the Emperor, which was not true. We weren't loyal to the Emperor. We were Americans. And for them to just presume, just because we look like the way we look, that we have a racial loyalty to the emperor was insulting. So if you answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the emperor, that no applied to the first part of the very same sentence. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered that truthfully and said, if they were so desperate to prove, what citizen has to prove their loyalty? But we were asked that. And if they answered that question, just that first part, truthfully, and said yes, then that yes applied to the second part of the very same sentence, which meant that you were confessing yet that you did have a pre-existing loyalty to the emperor. It was a lose-lose question. It was outrageous. And the amazing thing is, so many young men and women were so desperate to prove their loyalty that they bit the bullet, swallowed the ugly taste, and answered yes to those two questions.
That's George Takei, of course. He's an actor and an activist. His book is They Called Us Enemy. This month, the Radio West Book Club is reading the book. They're getting together over Zoom to discuss it on Monday night. And you're invited, of course. You can get information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The actor and activist George Takei is with us this hour. We're talking about his graphic memoir, They Called Us Enemy. It's about his experience as a boy living in Japanese-American internment camps during World War II. Along with his parents, his brother and sister, they were sent from their home in Los Angeles to rural Arkansas to the Roer Relocation Center. It's one of the 10 camps set up by the government. The family settled in, but Takei writes about this moment when his parents refused to answer yes to two questions in a government loyalty survey, questions that asked them to serve in combat and to swear allegiance to the United States. This, mind you, while they were being held captive. The two no answers from his mother and his father got them sent to another camp, this one in Northern California, a maximum security center called Camp Tule Lake. I wanted to ask you a story about Camp Tule Lake because this it's interesting. You write about it was there where you discovered the power of movies. So I wanted to have you talk a little bit about that. What influence did some of those films that you were watching? You, for example, tell the story of the Banshee,
yes,
these Japanese performers who provided the sound for some of the silent films. And you saw them as, and you saw them as artists. And so I'm wondering what influence did that experience there in this camp have on you maybe later becoming an actor, becoming a performer, seeing artists like that?
I think I had the basic instincts there. Yeah. That was just stimulated by the Banshee. They were, they showed movies every couple of months in the mess halls. The tables were cleared away and the benches were lined up. And we all gathered in the mess hall for those that wanted to see the movie. And most of them were old Hollywood movies. One of them that I still remember is Charles Laughton as the Hunchback of Notre Dame. It was fascinating. And it transported me to Paris. And so that those were escapes that we looked forward to. And in many ways, they were liberating from the barbed wire fence for the 2 hours that the movie was on. And occasionally, they had old Japanese samurai films that they showed. Either the soundtrack was lost or they were originally made as silent movies. And so there was a man that came with the film when they were screened. He was in another block, but he traveled around with the Japanese samurai movies. And he had a table set up with a young man assisting him. And the table had various sound effect tools like triangles and coconut shells and rocks and things like that to accompany the soundtracks, that create the soundtrack for the action on the screen. And he provided the dialogue as well. He did the dialogue for all the characters.
Wow.
The lord, the samurai, the princess, all, everyone. And that was, to me, absolutely fascinating. The lord would speak, and I've memorized some of the lines.
Oh, please.
Seishanuryodonainominatuni ikokuno funi ga haitta. And the samurai would say, ha, kashikomarimashita. And the princess would say, one man becoming all those many, many characters. It was fascinating. And I was focused more on him at the bottom of the screen to the left-hand corner than the image on the screen itself. And my father told me that in Japan, those people are called Benshi. And he told me that they are considered real artists. And after the war, I mean, I'm of the radio generation. Hmm. We were living on Skid Row at that time. But the first purchase that my father made was a portable radio. And here was this machine, this tiny rectangle, that transported me to the American West in Red Rider or Cisco Kid or to Metropolis with Green Hornet. It was, I mean, again, sounds that took me to another place and voices that played out a whole drama. So I think that's what really kind of stimulated my instinct that was already dormant inside me.
I want to come back to this, another moment of outrage that is so remarkable in the telling of the story that involves your mother. This is in 1944, and there's this bill introduced that would expatriate some of these Japanese Americans. And, yes. And the question is, you know, I guess the idea was that they were going to exchange these supposedly disloyal Japanese people to the government of Japan for American citizens, you know, who are being imprisoned. And
right. Prisoner exchanges.
Prisoner exchanges. And the idea was that you could renounce your citizenship.
Yes.
And so this question became, should you go? Should you choose to basically become an enemy? Should you renounce your citizenship? And this was a decision that your mother makes to renounce. Talk about this. It's very complicated.
It's very complicated. The radicalized young men became a real problem for the administration of Tule Lake. And they wanted to get rid of the Hoshidan, they're called, somehow get rid of them. And so they Congress passed the bill that gave them, in quotes, the right to renounce their citizenship. Any American has the right to renounce their citizenship. Can you imagine? In the midst of a war, giving the right to renounce their citizenship in the most turbulent prison camp, concentration camp, in of all the 10 camps that we had. And so they gave them that right. And they began, but they were only those people, the radicalized ones, that renounced. And they wanted to increase their numbers. And they began agitating to get other people, you know, by telling them, you know, this government treats you like garbage. Why do you continue to, you know, kowtow to them? Renounce your citizenship, join us, and be part of the group that's going to rise up. And my mother was not that kind of a resistor. She didn't want to do that. But because the agitation continued, and and Congress and the administrators of the camp really wanted to be rid of this problem, they announced that they're going to close down Tule Lake. In other words, let everybody out. The irony then, though, was that the barbed wire fences that kept us incarcerated was also our protection from the rednecks who were taking pot shots at Caucasians' friends and attorneys that were coming to the lake depend us. My mother, well, everybody was terrorized because those barbed wire fences ironically protected us. My mother was against the renunciants. But now, given this crisis, she took her stand and she renounced her American citizenship because the Hoshidan people said, if enough of us renounce our citizenship, then we'll force the government to keep Tule Lake operating. And for that purpose, to protect her family, my mother renounced her citizenship. My mother became a renunciant of her American citizenship.
We should point out, those of those listening in Salt Lake City, of course, that there was a tiny moment when you were thinking about, your father was thinking maybe after you're released from the camps, you would go to Salt Lake City. Didn't end up working, but I guess there was a moment you thought about it.
Yes, yes. My father's older brother had his family here, but he sensed the winds of war, and he sent his family, his wife and four children, to Japan for safety, again in quotes, before Pearl Harbor happened. And so he was alone, and he had more flexibility, so to speak. And when the internment came down, he was able to flee. There was a line drawn across the western part of the United States. And Salt Lake City was outside that line. So my uncle fled to Salt Lake City. And after the war, when my parents were looking for a place to go to, my father had a letter exchange with his brother in Salt Lake City. And my parents did consider going to Salt Lake City, but they were more familiar with Los Angeles, and they ultimately decided to come back to Los Angeles. And there we were on Skid Row, which to us as kids was the most horrific part of the internment. Being let go was horrific, because in camp, at least we had order, regimentation, and regularity. You know, three times a day in the mess hall, showering all together at the appointed time. But Skid Row was sheer chaos. And I still remember the stench of human waste everywhere, all day long. The smell, the sight, the things that happened, and the chaos, the sirens going day and night. And suddenly our Skid Row hotel room glowing red with the police car parked outside. It was a horrible place. Thank God it was only for about 4 months.
George Takei, his graphic memoir is They Called Us Enemy. This month, the Radio West Book Club is reading the book. They're getting together over Zoom to discuss all of this on Monday night, and you're invited. You can get information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the actor and activist George Takei. We're talking about his graphic memoir, They Called Us Enemy. I should say our conversation came earlier in the week, before the mass shooting in Atlanta, where a white gunman killed 8 people, 6 of Asian descent. But the issue of anti-Asian violence did come up. You say that most Japanese Americans of your parents' generation didn't actually want to talk about that experience, but your father was an exception. He was willing. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about those conversations that you had with him, and in particular, the questions you had and the sense of anger that you had that you write about in the book as well. That you, one of the things that you expressed to him was that he was being too passive, that he shouldn't have been consenting to these terrible things. You know, why did you take us to those camps? Why did you comply with something that was so fundamentally wrong? These were almost accusations you were making with your father.
They were. And I regret. Those are the conversations that I, to this day, still regret having had. And the things I said were horrible things that I said to the man I love, the man who protected us and guided us through all that. And so in retrospect, those are the conversations, and one particular one that I am deeply, profoundly sorry that I said. That was where I did say, "Daddy, you led us like sheep to slaughter into those barbaric prison camps." And suddenly our conversation stopped and he was silent. And I immediately realized that I had hit a nerve, and I felt terribly, but I'd said those words, and that silence seemed eternal. But then he said, "Well, maybe you're right." And he got up and went into his bedroom and closed the door. That was the end of the conversation. And I felt awful. I knew that was, you know, insensitive of me. And I wanted to go to the bedroom door and knock and apologize, but it was awkward. And so I thought, well, I'll apologize tomorrow morning. And when tomorrow morning came, it was even more awkward. And I never did apologize for that horrible thing I said to him. The man who gave me guidance and love and who I loved, I never had the guts to say, "I'm sorry I said that." And I feel that writing about it in the book is my way of apology. And I hope it's an expiation as well.
I wanted to ask you about something I was reading the other day. There was I was reading a piece recently by the journalist Kathleen Howe. Her parents are Asian-American immigrants from Taiwan. And one of the things she says in this piece is that anti-Asian racism, this idea that Asians only belong in Asia, has been around, you know, since the 1800s. You've referred to that before as well. Mm-hmm. But she mentions that how since the coronavirus pandemic began, that anti-Asian racism has been on this really sharp rise, that there was one estimate that 100 anti-Asian hate crimes were being committed every day in the country, 20 assaults in 2 weeks in Oakland's Chinatown. I mean, there's a lot of reports here, and I'm wondering, George Takei, what do you make of that?
I have a larger picture of it. It is as organic a part of American history American history. Because as I said a little bit earlier in our conversation, from the very beginning, Asians were discriminated against by being denied a naturalized citizenship. Yeah. And in 1871, in my hometown of Los Angeles, a white woman claimed that she was attacked and harassed by a Chinese man. Chinatown was right nearby. And immediately, a large vigilante mob was formed. The men went into Chinatown, dragged out 17 Chinese men into the central plaza, where there was a tall, big tree, and they strung them up. 17 Chinese men were literally lynched in the central plaza of Los Angeles. And that plaza is our historic plaza. And that same tree now is a giant tree. But in 1871, 17 Chinese men dangled from that tree. And certainly incarceration of people who looked like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor, who Americans of Japanese ancestry were summarily rounded up. And so again, anti-Asian, to put it broadly, but it was specifically anti-Japanese hate, swelled up, and we were imprisoned for 4 years. But the discrimination still continued after that. And what's happening today is consistent with that long history, the continuous history of hate of people who look like us. It's essentially hate of people of color. And we know that, you know, the African-American situation goes back to 1619. And yes, slavery itself actually ended with the Civil War, but the hate has been continuing and ongoing. And now, in the 50s and 60s, it took the form of the Civil Rights Movement, and now it's Black Lives Matter. But the hate of people of color is organic to American history.
Well, one thing you write about is that it took until 2018 for the Supreme Court to overturn the Korematsu ruling that basically upheld the exclusion of Japanese Americans from serving in the military. But this Korematsu ruling was struck down on the same day that the court upheld then-President Donald Trump's ban on immigration from Muslim countries, which made—
Isn't that ironic?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask about. So in that sense, what do you think has changed? I guess nothing.
That's why, you know, I say raising the awareness on that chapter of American history where that Japanese Americans were incarcerated, where my family and I were incarcerated, teaches object lessons of importance for all Americans until all this ends. And this Asian hate now, where because of the coronavirus having originated or started in Wuhan, China, we had a has-been president that continued to refer to it as the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus or Kung Flu, that we're now going through, again, another resurgence of hate against Asian Americans.
The question comes up, to me anyway, why it is you don't – I mean, clearly you are angry about what happened, but it doesn't seem like you hold that anger in. You have this kind of nuanced perspective in part that seems to have come from your father talking about the flaws of the system. One of the things you, when you were asked why you aren't more angry, is you said, because it would be another barbed wire fence around my heart. Would you finally explain what you mean by that?
Well, we were incarcerated behind barbed wire fences because I looked different from the rest of America. But as I grew up, with a growing realization that I was different again in a different way, that my orientation was to other boys and later to other men. And I didn't want to be different. And particularly because I wanted to pursue an acting career. And if you're different in that way, I could not be an actor. And so having the instinct to act, I thought I would deal with it by acting like, again in quotes, a normal guy, be like the others. And in high school, when my buddies were dating, I dated girls. So I grew up with a self-created barbed wire fence around my heart. In 2005, an extraordinary thing happened. The California State Assembly passed the Marriage Equality Bill. It went to the State Senate, and it passed there. And it landed on the governor's table, desk, and the governor happened to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. And when the bill landed on his desk, he vetoed it. I felt I needed to speak out. And so in my 60s, I came out and blasted Arnold Schwarzenegger's veto. And I became wholly, fully, 100% me.
Yeah. George Takei, thank you so much.
Thank you.
George Takei, his book is They Called Us Enemy. We should mention that George is coming to the Moab Music Festival next fall. He's going to narrate a new musical work based on the book. It was commissioned by the festival and composed by Kenji Bunch. You can learn more about it on our website, radiowest.org, where you can also learn about our book club. We're reading George's book this month, and you're invited to join the club and to talk about it over Zoom on Monday night. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.